And that was Boiling Ryan Seacrest in a Bag. And next on Radio Flange Goblet, we are very pleased and in some areas moist to introduce this clip from Vetti Wang's new film all about men, architecture and sex. It's cleverly called Erection, and don't worry, it won't be available anywhere. You'll be forced to see it by a pretentious loved one or an annoyingly depressed cousin. And the video run will be very small indeed, and only sold via speciality shops and brothels. Right, what have you got there, Henry?
Well, Bob, if you must know, and I know you must, it's the Thaddeus design for the new prestige office building downtown.
Isn't it awe-inspiring?
Yes, very good, very good. Very tall, very rounded, very new. I've been staring at it now for quite some time, and you know, I think it's going to reinvent modern architecture as we know it. I can't take my eyes away.
And what are those two rounded mounds at the base?
The atriums? Oh, yes, glad you asked. They are the latest in foyer design. The technology used in their core structure comes direct from NASA. One's the entrance, the other's the exit. They'll be manned 24/7 with the latest in customer service operatives, who in turn will be manned by smaller, more compact and shinier customer service operatives on a stool under the desk. And all four of them will have their teeth whitened at least every 3 days.
Great. Now, let me ask you, Henry, and this is just something that has started to bother me these last few moments while you were detailing in exquisite tones how one will navigate entry into the building.
What's that, Bob?
Well, forgive me for asking, Henry, but is it me or is this building shaped like a giant dong?
What do you mean, Bob?
You know, Henry, a male part, the old chap, a Johnson, well... There's really no other way to put it. A big old penis.
Now, don't be silly, Bob. I hardly think we would have put 2 years' worth of money into designing a... Oh, wait a minute. Now I see it. It's an enormous cock. Get Thaddeus on the phone.
Thaddeus?
Howdy there, Bob.
Could you come in here a moment?
Ah, sure thing, Bob. Oh, do I need to have my pants on?
Yes, Thaddeus, pants would be preferable.
It's really quite incredible, Bob. It does seem that we financed a massive metal and glass hard-on.
Hello there, guys. What can I do for you? Well, Thaddeus, pardon us for saying, but Henry and I were just looking at your designs for our new office building and, well, it's just... To us, it does appear you've simply just designed a big phallus.
Phallus? Oh, wait, you mean a dick? Yeah, that's right. I modelled the entire building after me old trousers, Nate. Inspiration often comes to me in the sleepy moments just after sexual congress. Any more questions, or can I get back to...
And you think it's okay to have done this, then?
Yeah, of course. Why not? It's architecturally sound, the measurements are accurate, it's a good, strong, natural shape, symbolises power, strength, life.
But it is still a massive prick.
That's right, yeah. I see, well, thank you, Thaddeus.
Wait, what is it you're working on if this is now finished?
All right, yeah, the landscaping it in the building. I'm going to have all the bushes planted in the shape of an enormous vagina. See you later.
The man's a genius. Radio Flange Goblet, it's time for this week's episode of everyone's favourite excuse to go out and kneecap some dogs, kick the clergy, urinate on the elderly, dance a naked and merry jig in the aisles of your local 8 till late shop, and throw Molotov cocktails at your auntie. Yes, it's the aftermovie diner, which this week comes from the Flair the Mare Bear Kerfuffle Poop, a new hunchback-themed dessert restaurant where all the waiters dress as Inuits and all the waitresses have enormous glue-on beards and hit you about the head and neck between courses with a rubberized effigy of Kofi Annan.
Good eye.
Hey, hello, and welcome to this, the After Movie Diner. And I just wanted to remind you all before we start the show properly that you can always rate and review us on iTunes. I would like you to do that because it would really help the show. And also, you can rate and review us on TalkShoe.com. Like some people, they kind of say, well, I don't like using iTunes. You got to put in a credit card and have an account and all that kind of stuff. All that kind of guff, you know what I mean, matey? So you can actually rate and review us on TalkShoe. What the hell is TalkShoe, you're all saying? Well, let me tell you. TalkShoe is where I upload the episodes every week, and you can go right there right now if you want to. It's quite simple. You just type in www.talkshoe.com/TC, you know, like Top Cat, TC, right? /110745. That's right, right? www.talkshoe.com/TC/110745, or alternatively, just go to talkshoe.com and type in After Movie Diner, you fucking lazy dingoes, right? So, do that, and you can rate and review on there. You don't have to put a credit card in or nothing. It's great. It's fantastic. So please rate and review the show. I'd love you for to do that. I don't know why I'm using an Australian accent this week. I don't even know why my Australian accent kind of veers drastically between South African and Australian. I don't know what's going on. I don't even know why I started this. But rate and review the show on iTunes and TalkShoe or wherever the show can be rated and reviewed. Either that, or I don't know, when you're sitting around the table with relatives or a friend, why don't you mention us in a loud voice? Or alternatively, you know what you could do? You know what you really could do if you wanted to support the show? Like, if you want to support it for free, just rate and review us on iTunes or TalkShoe. Go do it today. I don't know why you haven't done it already. I know you all download it and listen to it because I see the numbers. I see the numbers when you do it, so I know you're all out there listening. So why don't you go do it? Why haven't you done it already, huh? What are you waiting for? But if you really want to support the show, if you really want to, like, put your money where your mouth is, if you really want to, like, advertise us to everyone you come across, you could do a lot worse than go over to www.cafepress.com/aftermoviediner. And if you do that, well, you'll find a whole range of things you can buy, like T-shirts and hats and mugs and mouse pads and badges or buttons or whatever the hell you call them. You can do whatever you want. There's like a whole range of stuff. You can buy like a little, like one of those things that posh women have on the subway. Like they got those things where they put the coffee and the tea in them. Like those flask things. You can even buy one of them with the After Movie Diner written on it. Why don't you go do that? They've got all sorts of bloody things on that website. They've got all sorts of like different designs and stuff. And if I tell you what, if there's a design you'd like to see that you've seen on, like, our website or something, and we haven't got it on the T-shirt pages or the mug pages or whatever, and you want to see it on the, you want to have that printed, you want to do, just email me at aftermoviediner@gmail.com and I'll stick it on a T-shirt for you. I'll do anything you want. Just fucking write to me and tell me what you want. I'll do it. I'm a pushover, me. I do this show for free. I've done forever. You guys just go out there listening to it, downloading and whatever. I don't know if any of you give a shit. I'm just sat here in my basement doing nothing. Don't even have clothes. Anyway, on with the show.
This fucking front room, it just never get in this cold. This front room just doesn't get warm. It's just freezing cold. Half the flat's just off limits.
Oh, see, over here we've just had our cold spot. We just had our cold spot for the last whatever it was, the last few days.
Yeah, well, we had one, and then it just came back. Anyway,
you're outraged.
So, what have you done today? That just been lazy and
I've been lazy.
different. Every time I look at you, you've got a different T-shirt on. Every time.
No, I mean, I was wearing this a minute ago.
No. Well, yeah. But for every podcast, you've got a different T-shirt on. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I bought and had made a ton of T-shirts, so I'm sort of Mr. T-shirt now.
Excellent.
What have I been doing today? I really just sort of watched the movie, and then I've been fiddling with the green screen, which I bought myself.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, it's I don't know what you can see, but like it's a green screen. It's on two tripods, and yeah, it's all very exciting. So I bought that, and I've been
too fun to be had there. Do you think?
Yeah, I've been doing a puppet advertisement for my audiobook, which came out finally. Of the old novel.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah, so I've been doing that, and then tonight we're going to see Mumford & Sons at the Barclay Centre. It's going to be fun.
Because that girl from Drive is mazzard to the lead singer or something, isn't she?
Oh, what? Depressing Mook Depression. What's her face? what is her name? She just plays Drippy. Okay. There's two of them, and they've both been in movies with Ryan Gosling. Because he is also Mr.
He's also going to be in that bizarre-looking, I personally think, a Bridge Too Far adaptation of The Great Gatsby that's coming up.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah, by Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah, I think Luhrmann is going to, even among his acolytes, I think he's going to get found out. Because I read the books. I thought, well, I want to read the book before it comes out. And having read the book, I just don't understand how that film can bear any relation to that book. But
well,
anyway,
well, it won't. What's her name? Yeah, Michelle Williams is one of them, and who's the other one from Drive? I forget.
Yeah, she didn't. Yeah.
But her and Michelle Williams, if they're in a movie, it signals the most miserable time you will ever have with a film. And if Ryan Gosling is also in that movie, you've had it. You've absolutely had it. It's going to be flat out one of the most depressing films ever made. What is her name? She's English as well. She just stares out of windows blankly. Like,
yeah, I can remember.
Waiting any moment for death.
She didn't let me go as well.
Carey Mulligan, that's it.
That's it, yeah.
Ugh. Ugh. If Mulligan or... Williams are in a movie. Just back away.
I just leave it, really.
Yeah.
So you're going to see them tonight, are you?
Yeah, we're going to go see them tonight.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, we're going to the Barclay Centre. And I mean, it's fun. I mean, I like it because it's got that kind of rootsy sound to it. And I haven't seen a gig in ages.
For me, it was... I actually loved the first album the first time I heard it. And then it very quickly... The sheen faded off it really quickly, but I bet they're amazing live, though. I bet they're really good live.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. And I haven't been a gig since the Tragically Hit with Jim, and I haven't been to a gig with Doors since Tom Waits. So it'll be good.
Yeah.
It'll be fun. And it just so happened to be
prezzies.
Got good prezzies. Well, I got myself the green screen. We've got I bought a ton of DVDs recently. My buddy Phil got me a newspaper. You know, I'm like, I don't know if you've seen, but I'm a big fan of this independent Baltimore film director called Don Dola, who makes these alien invasion movies. Phil managed to track down on eBay a local Baltimore paper that had like a 20-page spread all about his films in it. And it's like a vintage thing from the early noughts that's all like wrapped up and stuff. Looks really good. It's got a big splashy front cover, so that was awesome. I got some whiskey, but so this week, what are we doing? So well, let's do the introductions and then we'll talk about it. Okay, hello and welcome everybody yet again to another episode of the After Movie Diner, and because it just doesn't ever get old, it's another Woods and Weller spectacular. Only this time we're delving into two that are possibly some of their most well-known ventures. And with me as always on the road to Woods and Weller unlike The Road to Wellville. It's John Monsignor Wallace. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm at the crossroads of Mad Goggly Eyes and...
Deadpanville.
And Deadpan, yeah. I'm good. As I say, it's freezing cold in London again. Otherwise all good.
And for people listening, although it won't be when you listen to it, today is my birthday. So if we make mention of that, that's why. But it happens to be a good time to record because I'm home on my birthday and not at stinky work, which is always good.
Which is lovely.
So what are the two, sir, that we're following, that we're covering today, sir? What are the two movies?
So we're doing, once again, we've picked from the same year. So this is from 1991.
Yes, 1991.
And we've got Naked Lunch as well as Effort and The Hard Way from Monsieur Woods.
Indeed. And quite sort of an odd pairing. I wouldn't suggest it as a double bill. Well, I mean, unless you want to go completely bonkers.
I don't know. I mean, it works for me because Naked Lunch is such a mad watch that and very twisted and dirty that, you know, slipping in the hard way as a sort of fun comedy afterwards was actually a remarkably good antidote for me. I watched them straight back to back as a double bill and it actually worked quite well.
Yet again proving the theory that Woods and Weller are at polar opposites of the temper spectrum, the acting spectrum, the, you know, choice of movie spectrum. I mean, really...
On this one, in terms of their acting styles, they are at polar opposites. They really are. Yeah,
well, Weller is practically in a coma being wheeled around by Cronenberg.
Yeah, it's an amazing performance. I mean, I think it's a fantastic performance. I think he really holds the whole thing together.
Yeah, completely. What should we start with, sir? I don't mind what we start with, but what do you want to start with?
Let's say in the movie they should the order they should be watched, which is Naked Lunch first.
Okay.
When I started writing Naked Lunch, people offered their opinions. Disgusting, they said. Pornographic, un-American trash, unpublishable. Well, it came out in 1959, and it found an audience. Town meetings, book burnings, and an inquiry by the state Supreme Court. That book made quite a little impression. Now, 30 years later, Hollywood, in its infinite wisdom, has turned it into a movie. 30 feet tall, in living color. Cover your eyes, America. Run for your lives.
You're a mocked man, Bill.
You're just gonna have to leave town.
Tourist class, I'm afraid.
Thought you were finished with doing weird stuff.
I thought I was too, but I guess I'm not.
I was quite jealous because you said that you've got the Criterion edition, so there was probably some juicy extras on there.
I watched about half an hour of a making of, which threw up a few bits of interesting facts and things.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, that Naked Lunch is based on the book by William Burroughs, but it's one of those sort of it's an unfilmable book, and so Cronenberg has taken all different bits and pieces of Burroughs' life and work and slipped them together and vaguely put them around Naked Lunch, because Naked Lunch, I'm ashamed to say, I've actually got a fantastic copy of it up on my bookshelf and I still haven't read it. But it's, from what I understand, it's basically a collection of very disparate bits and pieces. And this, what Cronenberg has, obviously as a massive Burroughs fan, has set about trying to turn it into something with a bit more of a narrative. And even then, it's quite a harsh job. Basically, William Burroughs, in his real life, I mean, the film is based almost more on his real life than the book, in that Burroughs famously said that he
he was in Mexico and he accidentally shot his wife during a very grim, drunken episode in an American-owned bar in Mexico City and had to sort of flee the country and everything, doing this William Tell routine, which appears in the film. And he has said that he became a writer because of that event, and that event colours... it reputedly colours nearly all of his writing. He has been said by some famous people to be, you know, uniquely touched by genius and probably, you know, a far better writer than, you know, his contemporaries like Kerouac and Ginsberg and people like that who helped him actually put the book together. So the story of the movie, such as it is that Bill Lee, who is William Burroughs' alter ego in most of his work, is an exterminator who hangs around with some sort of bebop kind of other writers.
That's the third time you've used the phrase bebop, I think, in one of these podcasts.
Yeah, because this is why he was born to play this role. So he's an exterminator, and he and his missus, in a very grisly turn of events, become addicted to his bug powder, which he uses to exterminate. They inject it, they cook it up, they inject it, and the line between reality and hallucination completely disappears, and he basically finds himself in this place called Interzone, which for all intents and purposes is tuners, this sort of zero morality, anything goes, hot baking North African city of intrigue. And he is, in some way, he believes he has become a secret agent working on behalf of whose boss is his bug typewriter, and he sets about becoming a sort of homosexual, intriguing nut bar wandering around this mad landscape. I mean, you don't want to be... the funny thing is that you don't actually want to be told too much about it, because it is utterly fucked up in every conceivable way.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, because I mean, I think it's about the second time I've seen it, but it's certainly the first time I've seen it as an adult who would be able to sort of understand the underlying meanings of certain bits. And it's difficult to, like, explain the plot chronologically, even in, you know, allegory terms, because what happens is you're like, okay, I've got a handle on this bit. This bit is an allegory for, like, writer's block and, you know, becoming controlled by the typewriter and machines versus longhand, and there's all this sort of stuff. Then the next bit is like, okay, then it becomes like an allegory for a drug overdose and then weaning yourself off drugs. And so then suddenly it becomes this whole thing about repressed homosexuality, and that takes on... And it's sort of building and building and building and building allegory and meaning and metaphor on top of each other, sort of not really culminating in very much at all. But every time I was like, oh, okay, that's clever, they're doing this now, and they're talking about you know, the tension and the fear of actually sort of putting words onto a paper with a typewriter and all that. The moment they started to do that, and I was like, okay, I've got a handle on what this movie's about, then it became about something else, became about something else, became about something else. So yeah.
It's fair to say that what it is in a very, very screwed up way, it's a film about the writing process more than anything else.
Right.
And, you know, he said, like you say, this is the first time I've watched it in a long time, and it was great to watch it again, actually. And I very deliberately decided I'm not even going to bother trying to read things into it, and I'm just going to take the lines as they are. And all the stuff to me that makes sense and actually comes through is the stuff about writing. That he's got a brilliant line at the beginning where he's with his two friends, who are basically, as I say, Ginsberg and Kerouac, and says, I gave up writing at 10. It's much too dangerous. And this idea that writing is... so some brilliant, brilliant lines about it, like a writer lives the sad truth like anyone else. The only difference is he makes reports. Yeah, so there are some great, great lines about writing in there. And as you say, there's all this stuff about his relationship to the typewriter and the typewriter's controlling him. and also his Burroughs's own thing about using drugs in order to write, in order to get anything out. At one point, he's in this interzone setting, and obviously there's an attempt by his friends to reach him, and they say to him, you know, we've got to talk about your you know, your whole attitude towards drug use and the literary process, you know. But he gets into the bug pad at the very start by his wife saying to him, it's a very literary high, because she's the one who started taking this stuff to begin with, and that's what gets his attention and makes him take it in the first place. Although, you know, you pretty much think that he'd probably take it anyway.
Right.
But it's great as well, because it goes to this utterly mad world really quickly.
Well, because actually, when he's arrested at the very beginning of the movie, and he has his like first mad hallucinations, you haven't even seen him up until that point take the powder. You've seen his wife take the powder, but you're not even aware that he's necessarily on it yet. But then it becomes apparent, and then you also find out when he's arrested that he has a record of not just doing the bug powder, but of doing, you know, multiple different types of drugs and getting arrested for various different things in the past.
Yeah, and his wife is sort of, you know, he says to her, like, you know, I thought you were going to stop doing weird shit, because she basically just likes shooting up anything that happens to stroll along. But it's great. The two main things I'd say about it, watching it again, that struck me were this is one of Weller's best ever performances. I think he's absolutely fantastic in it. Like you say, at certain points in the film, he is virtually asleep the way he's delivering these lines, but just oozing cool. And he has some brilliant... throughout the whole movie, he has some fantastic lines. Obviously, you know, exterminate all rational thought is a brilliant, brilliant sort of tagline for the whole film. The thing actually which struck me about it most of all, which I think is the reason that I always had a little bit of a problem with it, because I want to say, oh, I love it, it's the best film ever. I don't actually think it is, and one of the things that sort of lets me down in it, and the thing that sort of kept me going and really got me into it the first couple of times I watched it, and then it didn't keep it going enough, was at the beginning, it's got this very cool, ultimately twisted sense of humour. And at the beginning, he has some brilliantly funny lines, and the way he reacts to this freaky hallucinations and all this stuff that's going on around him is just brilliant and like laugh out loud funny. Like almost immediately after he's shot his wife dead through this, you know, this perverse William Tell game, he winds up in this bar, sat next to this sort of young sort of gay hustler kind of a guy, and the gay hustler just immediately says to him, "Oh, I know someone who's an expert on sexual ambivalence." And Weller turns around to him and says, "I'm sorry, sexual ambulance, did you say?" it's a really good line. And the way he reacts to the first time he meets this bug typewriter, because basically when he gets arrested, the policemen suddenly turn very sinister and say, "Oh, we've got a bug. I think we've got a bug for him," because he's got all this bug powder on the table. And he says, "Look, it's bug powder. It's part of my job." And they say, "Okay, well, we've got a bug for you." And they bring out this typewriter box, take the top off, and you see these fluttering beetle wings and these claws emerge from inside the typewriter box, and it comes out and starts talking to him in this creepy voice, which is that Burroughs doing the voice.
I don't know who does the voice. I can look it up while you're talking.
Burroughs doing the voice, but the bug says to him. The bug immediately starts addressing him as this secret agent, and the bug is his controller.
No, it's Peter Beretsky who does the voice. Oh, who's also one of the other exterminators in the film.
Because Burroughs appears in it, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so, maybe. I don't know.
He does appear in it. I think he is one of the other exterminators.
I didn't know what he looked like till I watched the documentary afterwards, so I wasn't looking for him when I watched the movie.
Yeah, but the bug... So he's sat in the police cell with this bug, and the bug says to him, "You don't have to play dumb with me." And he goes, no, that would be foolish. He started talking to this enormous fucking beetle. And that's the only thing.
It's like the really obscene moment when the bug, and it happens later with his wife as well, but when the bug goes, "Could you rub some of that powder on my lips, please?"
Yeah, because it's got this sort of talking... Well, I mean, it looks like a sort of talking...
Well, it's a talking arsehole, isn't it?
slash vagina thing but underneath wings.
I think it's a talking asshole just because at the end of the movie he tells that little
brilliant story.
Yeah, which apparently a lot of Burroughs' books are made up of, these little anecdotes and little sort of surreal flights of fancy and these little sketches that Naked Lunch is made up out of, and which is sort of what Cronenberg is trying to sort of unravel in order to make this more coherent. And I think it's meant to be, sort of a talking bug's arsehole, I think. I mean, that's the idea. But when he says, like, can you put some powder on it, Weller does this perfect pause and then just go, oh, all right then. Just the way he does it is really good.
Yeah, and also him slipping off his shoe while he's talking to it, carefully slipping off his shoe in order to batter it to pieces is just brilliant. But like I say, in the beginning, that sense of humour, his reaction to all this craziness going on around him, I think kind of almost out of necessity, it kind of dissipates, that humour, and it becomes more and more about this twisted nastiness. And that makes it harder for me to stick with it. I mean, I think what becomes clear from our review of it is that, you know, we haven't read any Burroughs. I mean, personally, I don't think that's a bad thing for the purposes of the review, because, you know, it's a standalone film, and also it's Cronenberg's take on Burroughs' almost complete body of work and, you know, position as an artist, kind of a thing. But but just as a movie, and in terms of keeping me with what is a very, you know, screwed up, strange world, and and like you say, no real narrative running through it, I felt like I could have used some more of those Weller funnies, those super dry Weller gag deliveries going on throughout the whole film. I think that would have really helped me with it. Saying that, his performance is just fantastic, and also, you know, he shows incredible range with it. Like when he's really falling apart at certain stages in that, I just think he's fantastic. I think he's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all the performances are fine. I mean, apart from Julian Sands, who quite honestly should be wiped from the face of the earth, because Sands is just Sands is a ridiculous ham, is what he is. But apart from that, the performances are great, and you know, Cronenberg is doing a very, very clever thing. It's a very, very clever film in the sense that all this stuff is going on. It's, you know, it's weird. It's, you know, you've got these anthropomorphic bugs and you've got these, you know, mad visuals and sort of like sick devouring scenes where like one typewriter devours another, and, you know, all this stuff about sexuality and, you know, there's lots of weird things roped into there. And he does a very clever job of, you know, keeping it as level as possible. You still have to have an open mind to that, you know, beat way of writing, or that beat way of presenting ideas, which normally involves griminess, which normally involves, substance abuse of some kind. Which normally involves a very sort of lax moral when it comes to violence and sex. So you have to have sort of an open mind to that. My main problem with it is, and I think this is maybe what you're saying as well about, like, Weller at the beginning has this certain funny thing or whatever, and I would say it's maybe my problem with all drug films to some extent, is at a certain point, I understand that he's a genius, but why am I at this point even caring about this, you know, repressed homosexual junkie, you know, head case who seemingly believes that he can only write genius while, you know, high on a variety of things, doesn't really want to admit wholeheartedly who he is, and turns away his friend's help, even though ultimately they would help him get the book published and so on. The information about Burroughs' real life and what Cronenberg did to make this movie by picking certain things from Burroughs' life, putting it in the film, and then, you know, filtering it through the beat way of writing that Burroughs has, does make it more interesting with hindsight. But there was a certain point where I was like, I've seen everything I need to see of this film, and I was about 50 minutes in. Does that make any sense? Like, it could only keep going on with more of the same. I find a bit like that with two other drug movies that I like very much, but like Trainspotting and Fear and Loathing, both of which, though, are helped forward to some extent by, A, actual events happening, and secondly, by voiceover and, you know, a certainly
don't you think,
slightly but, I mean, more charismatic characters. Sorry.
But don't you think by a sense of humour as well, in both those cases,
yes,
they
definitely
have a really good sense of humour, and they... Because they recognise that both those films, what this film starts doing very well and then sort of loses a bit, is they recognise that, you know, not everyone in the audience is going to have experimented with every single drug in the entire world and isn't necessarily going to go, gosh, yeah, tell me about it. I'm imagining giant bug creatures talking to you. You know? I mean, I just,
right, exactly.
You know, and Trainspotting and Fear and Loathing but get away with a lot more by laughing at themselves and having a sense of humour about it. And I think a sense of humour helps you along with it, helps you access it, helps you put up with, you know, the greater excesses. It helps you compute it. And this starts off very well in that area. I mean, it's still got some, I mean, some good funny lines later on, like, you know, save the psychoanalysis for your grasshopper friends. You know,
right. Like that, you know? Well, no, actually, I have to say the best bit in the later half of the movie is when his two friends visit.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And they're sitting there going, no, you wrote this. This is what you keep mailing this to us and look at all these pages. And like, he's like, you think a sinister cabal couldn't do something as easy as mailing a letter or whatever he says? Like, he's got all this like sinister conspiracy theories rushing through his, you know, drug fever. And they're trying to say, but no, you're like, what you've written is amazing and you're going to get published before us. And he's like, you're both fools, you know. And that was a really nice scene. But then... It doesn't. It's not satisfying for me. But by the end, although it's infinitely saying more, doing more, and more intelligent than the other two movies we're mentioning in terms of the human condition and the nature of creating.
Yeah. Also being, you know, lost. You know, feeling lost and adrift and cut off. Like, you know, he's at one point he's got those two typewriters, and on one of them it says like, I seem to be addicted to something that doesn't exist. And the other one says, I'm so lonely, I can't connect with anyone. Come and rescue me. And he can't, like, to begin with, like, everyone is asking him, you know, or you could probably get him into bed, you could probably get her into bed and all this. And at one point it says, I don't want to fuck him, I just want to talk to him. Which again is another, you know, it needed to have more of that. More of his, you know, he needed to, for me, he needed to stay more of that character the whole way through, rather than becoming part of it. And I think he becomes... I suppose he's got to become more used to it, but he's got to keep a bit more on your side of you are a visitor to this world. You've got to have someone on your side there with you. And instead, he becomes a bit too much part of this mad, crazy interzone. And you feel a bit cut off until, like you say, like the scenes where his friends come and pull him back in and stuff. But it's very clever. I mean, in terms of him being like becoming lost in this drug world... And creating this all this stuff, sort of in spite of it, and being almost unaware of what he's creating, is very clever. It's very well done. I think the way that he frames the movie about being, you know, it's you know, basically at the end of the film, he has you understand basically that he's completed the book, and he goes on to this place called Anexia. Well, I wonder what that means. And so as he's moving on to his next work, again, the William Tell routine is replayed. And I think it's a very clever framing thing to say, you know, whatever he goes on and does, no matter when he completes it, he's gone through all this pain and everything, that experience, that terrible moment is going to be with him and still define everything that he does. And that's obviously like, that for me is what Cronenberg has taken from his life and gone, and apparently is through most of his work, is that this is sort of the defining, you know, this is defines him as an artist, this,
right,
this moment. And that's very clever. But it's just that there's all of that stuff with, you know, like the typewriter being... There's a lot of stuff where you're just like, oh, all right. You know, like the bit where they go along to... You know, he starts to relate a gay relationship with the sort of Huster kid, and he goes over to Julian Sands's house, and the typewriter being, like, put in a big furnace and rebuilt as the head and all that kind of stuff. It really... starts to lose me a bit there.
Well, where it lost me was that he goes over to seduce Judy Davis's character, Ian Holm's wife, Joan Frost. And there's that sort of very, you know, perverted scene where her Arabian typewriter becomes...
turns into a sort of arse-faced, cocktailed, like, bumfish or whatever.
Right. And starts, like, flapping all over them, which was great and sort of weird and wonderful and erotic and all the rest of it, and sort of odd. But then, you know, that gets shooed out of the room by, like, this mad German maid and then is replaced by the actual typewriter smashing on the floor, which leads Ian Holm to say a nice thing about, like, I can't, you know, I need a house with a typewriter in it, which is a really sort of nice writerly feeling or image. But then all of a sudden, like, it goes off and the maid is like this mad lesbian madam running like this fleet of lesbians and you know,
fleet of lesbians.
Well, she's in this bazaar.
That's a great collective term. That's,
you know what I mean? She's in this bazaar surrounded by, you know, exotic looking lesbians, and Joan or Judy Davis's character goes, I have to go and atone, and then she kind of goes and coddles up to the lesbian, and I'm like, yeah, but what does that, like, that doesn't mean anything. What is
no,
that?
No,
there's no,
yeah, it's a load of sort of, you know, just sort of sickness for the sake of it. And then, I mean, I'm sure it does, I'm sure, like, David could probably, like, explain to you in extreme detail what that's all supposed to mean, but it gets the second half, it just gets very, very flabby. And like I say, I had exactly the same reaction to it happened when I first watched it, which was probably around the age of about 15 or something, which was, I love him talking to his original typewriter bug controller. I like all of those scenes. I think it's really wrong in the most brilliant way. And I like him being funny and reacting to all this stuff with this incredibly dry, like we say, almost asleep performance. It made me think Weller would have made would have done a brilliantly weird Marlowe film. You know, again,
oh, yeah,
he's another candidate for to do a good Marlowe. But yeah, it just goes too far. It loses you a bit because, like, and I do think that's because, you know, Weller becomes part of this world, and you're just kind of, instead of being there with him experiencing it, you're just watching him do all this mad stuff that doesn't really make any sense.
I mean, the other movies that we talked about as well, Fear and Loathing and Trainspotting, are helped by the fact that there are straight, normal, and I mean straight as in not high on drugs, straight normals around these crazy people that just occasionally, like, I remember there's a brilliant bit in Fear and Loathing where he's talking about what ether does to you. Is it ether that he sniffs off the off the flag bandana? And then you see it, and he says it makes you act like an old drunk at an Irish wedding or whatever he says. And you're seeing it from, like, Depp's point of view, and the image is all, like, blurry and whatever. And then you cut to a static shot of what you, if you were straight and normal, stood at the front of a casino, would see. And you see them doing this ludicrous, funny walk, you know, towards the gates. And what that does is it allows you to kind of step out of it for a minute and, like you say, first of all, laugh at it. Secondly, see it from both the protagonist experiencing it and the observer, which helps you as an audience member kind of go along with the story. That's why I was so drawn to the scene in Naked Lunch when the two friends show up, because you finally get this, you know, back and forth. And in fact, although they're in his apartment in Interzone and seemingly in this, like, Arabian setting or whatever, or Tunis setting, you could imagine the same scene being played out with Weller feverish in a bed, either...
That scene is in his New York apartment. It's not in Interzone. If you look, when he's saying to them, like, you guys are babes in the woods, and he's talking about a cabal could easily do this, it's in his New York apartment.
Well, there wasn't enough distinction then, I guess, because I didn't think that at all. But what I was saying was that it could equally be set if he was writhing around in the bed having these hallucinations or having a fever dream or whatever, and then, like, either side of the bed trying to talk him out of it. Like, you could, that whole scene, that whole thing played out very well, because I could imagine it both ways. And I much preferred the film when I could see what it was trying to talk about, And when I could see what it was trying to do, once it slipped off into things which, you know, and I loved all the stuff about writer's relationship to the machine that it uses. I loved all that right up until, like I say, Ian Holm commenting on, you know, not having a typewriter in the house is, you know, enough to give him this nervous, you know, anxiety.
And but I loved the, did you like the, I really liked the Ian Holm telepathy.
Oh, that's that was incredibly well done. Yeah, 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 very well done. But, you know, apart from that, it then slipped into this stuff where I'm like, well, now I don't know what you're talking about, you know, and I'm really trying to see what point you're trying to make. And it's not, it's spiraled off. But the trouble is it's spiraled off in a situation where everyone appears to be spiraling off. There are no normal people here. You know, everyone in Interzone is crazy for one reason or another.
I mean, basically, it's encapsulated by Sans. And
which is never a good thing.
So the good parts of the film are Naked Lunch. And I suppose, you know, there is a scene where he's having breakfast with Julius Sands. So I suppose good parts Naked Lunch, bad parts Breakfast with Sands.
Yeah, right, exactly. Never watch a movie called Breakfast with Sands. No, and just for me, it lost something because it was like, okay, you had me and then you lost me because aside from going, okay, people have different sexuality, people take drugs, you know, people write. Apart from that, it's at a certain point, it's not saying anything else. It's not.
Yeah.
So very clever. I was a little detached from it, to be honest. Much better when it's funny. And I think we both, in our own way, had the similar experience with the film. And that was that while I can see it's one of Weller's best, it's you know, it's not going to be, and it's not going to be one I'll put in again. I love Cronenberg as a filmmaker. I've watched a lot of Cronenberg this year. We watched all the ones for the show we did. I've watched Dead Zone, which I covered on a different show, but and then I've watched this, and I do love Cronenberg as a filmmaker, but this one at a certain point did lose me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's worth seeing. It is a one-off watch, and the reason it's worth seeing is for Weller's performance. I think he is really magnificent in it.
Yeah, it just needed. I think if it had more of those, like I liked the asshole soliloquy that he gives about the girl, whatever. But it was also that whole sequence was like an allegory for the movie in the sense that. You're listening to the arsehole soliloquy and you're like, uh-huh, okay, no, I'm going with you. I understand it. No, you just haven't been able to end that, have you? That's my problem with it all. And I have a similar problem with a lot of beat novels. I mean, I'm a big Bukowski fan, but at a certain point, you're like, okay, I get it. It's grimy. You're doing a lot of drinking. You've done some drugs. You've slept with some unsuitable women. You know, you've written some stuff. You've talked about the passion of writing. You've done all this. Oh, okay. You know, like then what? And it just sort of drifts off.
He's probably been. It's a really brave attempt to do something with. You know, I mean, as far as I'm aware, the book was written to be for the in sections to be read in any order. You know, and it's things like that. So it's things like that that sort of beat almost dogma that has kind of. Restricted him to, you know, he's sort of gone, oh, well, I have to do a bit of this and it has to have this kind of a feel and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you probably do just have to do it that way. But to finish, like I've been saying the whole time, it would have kept me going a lot better if Weller was with you the whole way instead of just sort of becoming. The thing is, his character becomes lost, so you kind of do necessarily have to lose track with him a bit. But there needed to, there needs to be something to keep you with it, and it does. It does lose me a bit about two thirds of the way through. I'd say, like you say, about probably on the 50-minute mark. That's probably spot on.
Yeah, and I, you know, completely agree. People should check it out. I think it was a completely valiant, very intelligent, very creative effort on Cronenberg's part to do it at all. And you're right about the original book. It was written in stories, and it was really mailed in letters to Ginsberg. And it was then a compiled simply to be, I think, to have like a first draft published or whatever. It was sent off to some place in Paris. And they just sent it off willy-nilly and went, oh, just put it together and print it out just so we can kind of see how it all sits together. And they never changed it after that. There was no there was no attempt to even put it in an order that makes sense. It was published that way. I think they did some work with the ending of the book. I believe Burroughs he took something that was at the beginning of the book and changed it to the end of the book. But apart from that, the rest of the book was just put together as the French printers saw fit.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We will stick this together in any old order, and you will say it is the best.
I would check out some of the beat writers. Certainly in my university days, I liked them a lot. I haven't really sort of read a lot recently, but, I would certainly check it out.
I never really read any. But I've got a copy of it, and funnily enough, it did make me think I am going to read that bugger.
No, I think that's annoying as well, because in the documentary, they read out a lot of his prose. It's, like Hunter S. Thompson, like Bukowski, whatever, it's incredibly a delight to listen to. It's a delight to hear those words put together. It's a delight to hear those descriptions of things. You know, it's fantastic. And I think Naked Lunch could have benefited from, if not a voiceover, Weller spouting these, paragraphs of stuff at people more. That would have been...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that's one of the reasons I go back to Fear and Loathing. I don't ultimately care about the story. I just love hearing that language spoken. And that's what it's about for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're going to take a little break here to listen to some music and let you know about some other stuff that's happening online from us and our friends. First up, take a listen to this Diner Jukebox selection of Tin Roof Tap Dance from Moe's Haven. Now available on iTunes, CD Baby, and over at Amazon.com.
Love doesn't sparkle when the sun is bright. It's made for rainy days, it's made for foggy nights. Backyard porches and burned out floors, out of tune fenders playing jangly chords. I know I promised that I'd take you to France, but in the meantime listen to this tin roof tap dance. Western skies, we're gonna turn the lows back into highs. When the lights go out and we come in, there'll be nothing but the sound of the drops on the tin. Give Mother Nature a nice big glance. Listen, listen close to this tin roof tap dance. Just fine. Go ahead and dream, baby, take your time. You got white sand and a castle in Spain. I got you and me and the sound of the rain. Make a little time for sweet romance. Listen up close, baby, to this tin roof tap dance.
Curiosity Quills Press, Death, the Devil and the Goldfish by Andrew Buckley, the audiobook. And it's no ordinary audiobook. Narrated by me, your diner host, and available on iTunes, Amazon, and Audible.com, Don't pass up the opportunity to immerse yourself in the delightfully madcap and hilarious world of Andrew's terrific writing by hearing me read the novel and provide lots of silly voices for all the characters. That's right! This is no straight, boring old audiobook. This man is a performance. But what's it about, I hear you cry? Well, from the Bahamas to Heathrow Airport to the rain-soaked streets of London, the dead have ceased dying. This is inconvenient for a number of reasons, but what's the real reason behind the chaos? In London, we find Nigel Reinhardt, a disgraced, confused, and gifted London police constable who owns a prophetic goldfish. In Ireland, the Angel of Death questions the value and position of his current employment. At Majestic Technologies, Selena McManus works diligently on a top-secret project. At the South Pole, there lives a very unhappy penguin. When the devil hatches a nefarious plot to take over the world by possessing a cute little kitty and seizing a factory of robotic Christmas elves, it's up to Nigel and his group of unlikely companions to save the world or die trying. Or both. So, want to know what happens and what all those characters sound like? Well, pick it up today and help support independently produced creativity. From Audible.com, iTunes, and Amazon, it's Death, the Devil, and the Goldfish, the audiobook. Buy it!
Attention podcast shoppers. If you have a sweet tooth, we have a special treat for you. If you download an episode of Profondo Cinema in the next half hour, we'll give you a bag of audio ear candy free to take home to the kiddies or enjoy yourself. So, hurry and download an episode at ProfondoCinema.com.
Hi, I'm Steven Seagal. That's right, Steven Seagal. And for the past 40 years, in between barbecue and oxen and roasting boar for my insatiable appetite, I never miss an episode of Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid commentaries. Ain't that right, Johnny?
Hi, I'm Dr. Action.
Hi, and I'm the Kick-Ass Kid.
When I'm not watching action films, I'm usually polishing my gum while looking at a bat.
And when I'm not watching action films, I'm normally outside with a harpoon killing puppies.
But usually you can find us both watching 80s, 90s action films. You could follow us on Twitter, Dr. Action Kickass.
You can find us on our main page, which is dractionkickass.blogspot.com.
You can also find us on iTunes and TalkShoe.
Yes, every week we do a commentary on an 80s and 90s action classic, and where we can, we also provide the film so that you can watch along with it.
This podcast explodes.
Hey, where's that baby mama at? I gotta tase somebody.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is D.
And this is CJ.
We are two of the three black geeks. The other black geek is in Japan right now. That just shows you how geeky we are. We can do it across the globe.
Yes.
So, for anybody that want to hear just straight up
anime, news, video games, black movies,
yeah,
white movies, every
white movie,
movies, every movie,
all that stuff. Because, of course, everybody's going to say, hey, won't you guys do Meteor Man? Hey, won't you guys do that one movie that I really, really effing hate?
How about you guys do Steel?
Yeah, because a black person was in that. Yeah, you come to us for that. So, us, me, CJ, and our boy DJ Sue across the water, we are the three black geeks. So,
coming to your podcast weekly.
I know, you know that? That's just real right there. Get us on. You can hear us on Podomatic. You can also go to our website on GenXCast.com. And
if you're really feeling randy, you can go to our YouTube page, www.youtube.com/3blackgeeks, and you can watch our videos of everything, whether it be DJ Chisu's crazy adventures in Japan or some of our adventures playing video games or just random odds and ends.
And if you really want to get off to us and jack off, just go to our Facebook page. Look it up. 3 Black Geeks is right there.
Can't miss it.
Enjoy.
And before we take you back to the show, it's one more dip into the Diner Jukebox with Milky Onions and their song First Day. You can find their stuff on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/Milky Onions. Have a listen.
Wasn't meant to be this way. across the room. Someone flip, pistol whip, they'll start firing pretty soon.
First hand job.
Just made a human shield. Fat X, split heads. Finance try to strike a deal. No dice, I slice. Splatters up on the QWERTY keys. Shelled husk, bad luck. Their last day of counting things.
First day of the job. First day of the job. First day of the job.
And with that, let us transition rather clumsily
to a half-baked turn, cross the bloody Central Divide, smash through it in a James Woods cop-like scene, shooting a shotgun out of the window.
Yes,
into 1991's The Hard Way.
Movie star Nick Lang is looking for a part that could change his image.
You don't want me to grow up. The studio doesn't want me to grow up. I'm the only one who wants me to grow up!
So to play a real cop,
freeze.
He's going to study with the best.
If I can walk his beat, if I can get under his skin, I will nail this part, Angie.
Detective John Marks is on the trail of a killer.
This party crasher has whacked out 7 people. He's going to do it again, soon, today maybe.
And what if this cop doesn't want you tagging after him?
2 pros exchanging ideas. Why wouldn't he want to do it?
Not if you tied my tongue to your tailpipe and drove me 80 miles an hour naked across a field of broken glass.
Now evidently, the guy just wants to blend in so nobody knows he's Nick Lang, okay?
Yeah. Ah! My trainer's got me a Nautilus and the Stairmaster, so you don't have to worry about Nick Lang.
He doesn't belong here. He belongs in Never Never Land.
And you're never going to believe where I am. I'm in a ghetto.
He's told me face to face that he wants to be me. It's my life. It's my life. Moved into my house, you know.
I'll just
do what you do in Hollywood. Rum drinks, fern bar, gerbil racing. You know what's next? You know, my old lady.
What?
I know it.
Tell me.
You just kissed him? You kissed his face?
It's getting to where everywhere I look, I see his smiling face. I turn on the TV and I hear his voice.
All of my movies, including The Smoking Guns, are shot on biodegradable film stock.
There's only one way Moss can catch the killer without losing his mind.
NYPD! NYPD! I have got to get rid of this guy.
Michael J. Fox. James Woods. In a John Badham movie. The Hard Way. Coming soon to a theater near you.
All right, just stop!
The Hard Way, which, again, it's odd. We're talking about two of their most well-known movies. You know, The Hard Way is a sort of 48 Hours type cop and actor buddy comedy action thing. And we're talking about, like, two of Woods and Weller's most famous movies to some extent. And I have to say, while, again, I like The Hard Way and I like Naked Lunch, I also had problems with it. It didn't have the necessary humor or excitement as something like a 48 Hours or a Lethal Weapon or a Last Boy Scout or something like that. It could have done with a comedy rewrite. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean. I just think it's that what's brilliant about putting these two films in juxtaposition. I think the reason I enjoyed it so much is while Naked Lunch is such incredibly hard work, this is the lightest of light. This film. For anyone who doesn't know, the film is based around Michael J. Fox plays a sort of spoiled brat movie star who is in a lot of sort of very cheesy adventure movies, and he really wants to break out and do like a serious role. He's desperate to get a role as this sort of hard-bitten cop in a very gritty cop drama. And on TV, he spots James Woods, who is a real-life cop, chasing a serial killer called the Party Crasher, and gets all excited and uses his Hollywood connections to get assigned to him to be sort of embedded with James Woods as James Woods goes around the place being a policeman. And Woods, throughout the film, is supposed to have given up on the serial killer case in order to just, hold this bloke's hand around the streets, but refuses to give up on the case and takes Fox around him, and they begin to investigate the case almost together. While at the same time, Fox addresses Woods' personal issues through his sort of touchy-feely Hollywood background. I really liked it. I mean, one of the interesting things about talking about how light it is the director is a renowned director of lightest of light fare. I mean, he did Short Circuit, Stakeout. He did Saturday Night Fever. He did War Games. A lot of very light touch 80s movies.
Bird on a Wire.
Bird on a Wire, God.
And War Games.
And for me, I just thought it just barrels along in a fun way. I mean, Woods basically has been hired because he's the best possible person to play this sort of committed cop. And the film's best moments for me are he hates Michael J. Fox from the first moment that he meets him. And he regularly, throughout the film, completely loses his rag and yells at Fox about what it's really like to be a cop and how he'll never know anything about it, and goes off on these big soliloquies. And Fox, just stands there listening to it and then says, "That was brilliant," and whips out a tape recorder and says, "Can you do that again?" And says into his tape recorder, "Detective, whatever. The meaning of life," and says, "Go on, say it again," and Woods will grab it and throw it away. That's the best thing about the film. The serial killer thing is really weird, because the whole gatecrasher thing, at the beginning, you only see him shoot a sort of drug dealing sleazebag. He doesn't just kill everyone in the club, he just shoots a drug dealing sleazebag. So you're a bit so he's not that bad then, really. And he also lives in a massive palatial New York pad with the very latest computers, where playing 10 games of chess consecutively. That old Hollywood hooker, if he's a serial killer, he's got to be good at, she's got to be a chess fan. No serial killer would ever play dominoes or drafts or,
Well, he says at one point to Woods' cop, he says, "I'm a good guy, I'm trying to help, I'm trying to do your job, I'm trying to clean up the streets." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He sees himself as a sort of vigilante. And it's a very, very weird turn as well by the actor who's, had his hair dyed blonde and does a lot of nostril flaring and pierced eyed nonsense and giggling and all the rest of it. It starts off with possibly one of the most ludicrous scenes outside of Blue Jean Cop ever committed to a New York street, which is Woods's cop sees the killer in a nightclub, chases the killer outside. They then give chase, and Woods is hanging off the door of the killer's truck as it kind of careers through New York streets with his buddies in tow firing out of the car.
and yelling, Woods, shoot this guy, shoot this guy.
And Woods trying to, like, hit the guy with a crowbar and stuff, which, you know, is delightfully ludicrous. And I was thinking, great. But the trouble is that the movie doesn't continue that pace. And to some extent, the other action bits that are put in it, for me, considering we have only seen Blue Jean Cop recently, some of the other action bits in it didn't seem as charming or as ludicrous as they could have been, or, you know, done quite as well. I did find Michael J. Fox's character only ever so slightly the right side of annoying. Like, he's meant to be annoying, but he is... He's, and I find Michael J. Fox a very charming, very funny actor, but in this, it was... He was pushing my buttons too as well, just a little bit.
I mean, I really like both the minute. I mean, actually, now that, looking at my notes, there is a connection, believe it or not, Bruce Woods' speech with Naked Lunch through this film, through a couple of lines that Woods has. First of all, we talked about how there's this amazing prolonged scene in Naked Lunch with Weller talking about the talking arsehole, and his arsehole starts eating and everything else. Well, Woods has said at one point, when someone says to him, like, oh, come on, I want us to be friends, he says, yeah, maybe when my ass learns to chew gum. and also thematically linking it, as he does call Woods at one point, this new egomaniacal cockroach, he calls him.
Yeah.
So, you know, little links there. But I really like Fox in it. I think he's perfect for it. What I'm kind of interested in, actually, is I'm just trying to see how it did at the cinema, because it was Fox's first film after Back to the Future, and actually that actually syncs up completely with his part in the film, because this must have been a very important film for him, for this to be coming out after Back to the Future 3. It must have been really important to him to see how it went, because after this he does, like, I don't know, the only big other thing he did on this was he did, like, Doc Hollywood a couple of years later or something like that.
Yeah.
It says here it took $25 million in the USA, which sounds pretty respectable.
I mean, for 91.
$6.5 million opening weekend.
For 91, that's pretty good. I mean, depending on what they spent on it, though. I mean, if they spent like $80 million on it, it's probably not. But.
Mm. So yeah, I mean, I think it's basically just really good fun for Woods and Fox having a big old crack at each other. Well, just Woods screaming at Fox.
I think Woods is tremendous in it. I think Woods is fantastic in it. Fox, some scenes yes, some scenes no. The overall premise is a good, strong one for like a stupid buddy cop action movie. I don't feel that the action is ever fully up to par. I think that the whole ending is very weird, and, you know, with the whole, like, crowbarring in, the whole idea that his woman has to get kidnapped. I don't know. I love, like, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, but I have to say it's, you know, it's not one that I'm going to be putting in a lot of the time, because it didn't hit me on the level of other buddy cop films.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
and also Woods, like, Woods never softens. Like, there was never a point, even though Michael J. Fox, like, relentlessly is trying to help him out with his woman, and there is just an obscene scene when they're in this, like, little ale tavern where Fox decides to pretend to be a woman, which is just, I mean, borders on obscene. And and I think was written as funny. And look, Fox does a sterling job of trying to pull it off, but Woods is doing some stuff with his face in that scene, which is just...
Yeah, I really liked that scene.
Questionable and curious. I mean, he's...
Because Fox says, I'm not going to talk to you until you call me Susan, because he's pretending to be Woods' lady. And the struggle on Woods' face to get the word Susan out of his mouth, I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was really funny.
But it's... It was odd because, like, all of a sudden Woods is going, oh, and, like, doing this stuff. But I don't know how much he actually pulled the comedy off. I think it's far funnier to just have Woods being Woods than it is him trying to do a comedy bit. It just didn't... It just didn't fully sit well with me. It was like 70% of charming. It wasn't like fully charming. The movie needed to be, it needed just another bit of oomph about it, either some comedy oomph or some action oomph or something. And
I'd agree with you that it could have used some more, it could have used some better action in it, definitely.
It was a valiant effort, but it's not going on my list. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I think maybe had I seen it when I was 11, it would be on my list. Like, I think it's one of those, maybe. I think the reason why, you know, Last Boy Scout, Beverly Hills Cop, or Lethal Weapon, or any of those action movies, Die Hard, or whatever, are on my list is because I've watched them over and over again throughout my whole life. The hard way, this is my first time of seeing it. I know that for others, they love it so because it's got that nostalgic quality.
Yeah. I mean, a good piece of trivia, IMDb trivia connected to this film is that presumably Woods was persuaded to do the film by one of his perks was to have his own personal hairdresser on set at the cost of $6,000 a week.
Really?
And I read this before I saw it and I thought, I'm sorry, but I'm not seeing a $6,000 haircut there. I really am not seeing that.
Well, his hair's weird. I mean, I know that like in later roles he's dyed it because clearly his hair now is completely and utterly white. But there's something weird about Woods' hair. If you like Google Woods and look at it, I don't know whether it's a wig or whether it's just he uses too much Just for Men or something. Like his hair clearly needs maintenance.
I've talked a lot about both their hair throughout all of these Woods Weller movies, and I mean, at least it's not. I suppose you can say the $6,000 is worth it just not to recreate the True Believer cut.
True, yeah. Not to have that kind of mad ponytail dew perm that he had in that movie.
Yeah. But I've spotted, by the way, that Woods is in. I mean, I think that's pretty much it for The Hard Way. I mean, I think it's a nice little Sunday afternoon movie if you've not seen it. Completely.
And, you know, it's got some great scenes in it. You know, the frog dog scene springs to mind. And, you know, Woods is the best thing in it, I think. And I think Michael J. Fox acts very well, but I think maybe too well to the point where I'm like, no, I am actually annoyed by you now. There wasn't enough. I felt like it died at the scripting stage rather than necessarily anything in the film. I think the film's perfectly good. I think that you know, it could have been better, is how I felt.
Yeah. I mean, I agree completely. But, I mean, looking at what Woods has got coming up, I noticed that he's in that White House Down movie. It's called White House Down here. I thought it was actually called something else now.
Oh, what is it? Operation Omega or what? What was it? What's it now called?
I can't remember. Or, like, Eagle Down or Something Falls or something like that. Or maybe there are two movies about the bloody White House being taken over.
No, there are two movies about the White House being taken over. Is this the one with...
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not. There's this one with James Woods and Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx. And then there's another one with Gerard Butler as a sort of Jack Bauer type, basically redoing the bit where Bauer is trapped in the White House with the female president in season 7 or 8 of 24.
And Jamie Foxx plays the president in the James Woods one, which I'm sorry, but that's not... Where was Morgan Freeman? Black president, get in Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman's in the other one.
Oh, my God.
Not as the president, but he's in the other one. What does he play in the other one? Oh, this is it. The other one's called Olympus Has Fallen, and it looks terrible.
Incredible. Two films should be made about something that specific.
Morgan Freeman plays the Speaker of the House in the Olympus Has Fallen.
Right, okay.
Let me tell you the level of it. Ashley Judd plays the First Lady. And I'm sure they're selling it on Freeman and Judd back together again.
Yeah, what was that rubbish? Was that Along Came a Spider, was it?
Along Came a Spider and Kiss the Girls, they're both in.
Where Morgan Freeman wore aviator sunglasses and a leather jacket and a black roll neck sweater. And you're like, Morgan, sorry, can't pull that off.
No, but yes, Ashley Judd, Gerard Butler and Morgan Freeman. And then there's another one which is... Oh, wait a minute, they were in High Crimes as well. How many of these fucking ones did they do together? Kiss the Girls, High Crimes, and I don't know what the other one is. Jesus. Ashley Judd, there's an anomaly I'll never understand.
Yeah. But I mean, all in all, I think they're a good. I think The Hard Way is the perfect antidote to Naked Lunch. I think they're a good little double bill, and I enjoy a lot seeing what these two legends of the silver screen do in the same year.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm liking doing, and actually, you drew up a list and emailed it to me, and I've done my own research on Amazon and stuff and picked some stuff up. You know, I think someone on the Facebook page actually said this week, you know, loving the Woods and Weller series. And I was saying, you know what, there have been times where I've been a little bit worried about, like, doing this subject every week. But then, not worried for me, I've really been enjoying it, but worried, like, listeners going, Woods and Weller again? Can't we have them talk about something else? But actually, you know, think about the filmmakers we've discussed, think about the genres we've discussed, think about the performances. You know, it's been and will continue to be sort of a rich, varied. It's odd. We've sort of got into this seam, this trough of Woods and Weller that they've carved through the 90s. And it's really letting us go in lots of different places and talk about films I would never have sat down and watched. I love it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm really enjoying it too. I'm particularly enjoying seeing Woods and Dennehy in the same film. I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Oh, what was that for?
That's a bestseller, I think.
Oh, yeah. We have to do. I think we'll do bestseller and bestseller and 50-50. I think that's going to be a good double bill next.
I think that'll be a cracking double bill. Yeah.
So I'll try and send you. Well, I'll try and send you 50-50 today. And then at least we can get that watched by next time.
Yeah.
And you've got bestseller?
I've got bestseller waiting to be watched just there, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So, so then we'll do that next time then, bestseller and 50-50.
Lovely, sounds good.
But I'm really enjoying it, dude. I'm really, really enjoying talking these movies with you every week.
Yeah, me too, man. I'm really enjoying watching them. To be honest, with these two, these are a couple of films that I've actually, you know, seen a few times, both the ones we watched this time. Yeah. I mean, it was great to watch Naked Lunch again because I hadn't seen it in such a long time. And I think there's a lot there to be enjoyed. It sounded like we were coming down on it quite harshly, really. And I think that's because when you get to the end of it, you do feel a bit. It's one of those films that leaves you feeling a bit knackered, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's so much in there to enjoy, and Weller's performance is just fantastic in that. And that, something like Screamers, those are films that showed that. I think the guy has serious talent and could have done so much more. And like I say, could have made a great Chandler-esque figure, like a Marlowe or something like that. I just think he could have done brilliantly there.
But there are also two people that if you talk about leading men of the 80s and 90s, you would never, ever mention James Woods and Peter Weller. And yet, most movies they do, they're the leading guy. Like, they're the leading person in them. It's not I know that as the 90s roll on and then we get into the millennium, they start doing character bits and TV bits and they start sort of fading into the cast, ensemble cast and stuff. But, you know, for almost 20 years, they're up front and center in a series of movies. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, churning out films, yeah. Woods sort of seems to turn into a kind of voiceover artist at the beginning of the noughties. He just does loads and loads of random, like, video games and voiceovers and all this sorts of stuff. But like you say, a couple of decades, they're storming their way through the years.
Exactly. And, you know, it's showing once again that the 80s and flowing into the 90s, but mainly the 80s were a decade where you just had more diversity when it came to leading men. It wasn't just like, you know, Gosling, Marky Mark and Cruise in every fucking movie.
And, you know, there was space for some funny-looking buggers, you know. I mean, there are funny-looking buggers.
I mean, it always depresses me when I see a movie nowadays and Jeff Goldblum shows up for three scenes and then fucks off. And I'm like, Goldblum's another one. Used to be a leading guy, now does three scenes in, like, weak comedies. And you just think to yourself, I want, like, Goldblum and Weller and these people, put the leading man things, put them more, like, up front again.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Just, I think they might have a bit of a... I think someone like Weller and Woods, they definitely stand a chance for a bit of a renaissance. I think they do. I think it's just been the, I think, you know, 2000 to 2010 just wasn't kind to either of them, really.
Woods could do a good villain role. Woods could do a good, like, eye-rolling villain in a Tom Cruise action movie, even. You know what I mean?
James Woods can do anything. he can be all things to all men. He could do anything from an Elvis biopic to... bloody, he could play, you know, Admiral. He could play the Emperor Hirohito, as far as I'm concerned.
As long as he's angry. He could do angry anything. He can do angry cops, angry plumbers, angry.
I mean, both Weller and Woods are linked by a lot of cop related films.
Yes.
But outside of that, there's some real variety and some real interesting little movies there. And I was, you know, I was struck by how much we've talked about films that perhaps we thought we wouldn't talk that much about. For instance, like, you know, the Killer movie. Actually had quite a lot to say and is an interesting little movie and shows that he's, you know, he keeps trying to do good work. By the way, I also saw Nixon, and he's fantastic in Nixon as well. Nixon is a crazy mishmash of a film, and, you know, I knew it wasn't going to be because it didn't do half as much, but I was so hoping for, you know, JFK part two, basically, which it almost is in some ways, but it's all over the place, that film. I thought Hopkins was good. And I thought James Woods was good. I thought all the cast were brilliant. But it's Stone and his script are just absolutely all over the place. And if it went from black and white to colour, you know, if it suddenly went black and white one more time, I was going to scream. It was one of those, you know.
Yeah. Completely. I think I sat down years ago to watch Nixon going, oh, yeah, I really like JFK. I'm going to watch Nixon. About 10 minutes in, I'm like, this isn't JFK. I just turned it off.
But
excellent. Fantastic. I hope people are sort of going along with us. They seem to be. The numbers are good for the episodes, and people are enjoying the different movies we're covering. There's lots of, like, cult little ones that these guys have done that I think people like, and it's going to be interesting next time to see them both do action hero roles and see what that's
going to be. Are we sure that what year is bestseller? Now you see, bestseller is the same year as RoboCop, so we could have a bestseller RoboCop double, and then it would be it's 50-50 in Digstown is the other one.
Okay.
Which is the boxing picture with James Woods. Now, I am well up for a James Woods boxing picture. There's no doubt about that.
Okay, so 50-50 is 1990. No.
No, it's 92, as is Digstown, I think.
Well, why don't we do RoboCop bestseller, because you can get hold of both of those. I'll send you 50-50 and then we'll do that afterwards.
Okay, sounds cool.
So RoboCop and bestseller.
And 50-50 in Digstown.
Will be the next show. So next show and then the show after that. Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, if you wanted to plow on, there are other options such as...
We're going to do the one him versus rats. We've got to do that one.
Yeah. Well, I thought we could do that in Salvador. They're not the same year, but Salvador is 86 and of unknown origin, which is him and the rats, is 83. I mean, that has to be seen. There's no doubt about that.
Of unknown origin. Yeah, I can rent that. Of unknown origin and Salvador is another episode. Okay.
Yeah, and the final episode we could do, I don't know whether it's worth it because these are two films that I'm quite suspicious of, but I would be interested in seeing is the very end of their run, which is Woods in Vampires, John Carpenter's Vampires, where he's the lead, is he?
John Carpenter's Vampires is all right, it's not bad.
And then Ivan's Ecstasy is 2000, and I remember that getting quite good reviews at the time.
Yeah, okay, well, let's see. Let's do the next three shows and see how we feel about that one. Because, I mean, I've seen Vampires a couple of times. I wouldn't have a huge amount to say about it, to be honest.
Yeah, okay, fine, yeah. Well, I think we've got three more there, then, and then we've set Woods and Weller to rights, I think.
Yeah, well, then we are the podcast of Woods and Weller. If anyone is looking to really find out about these films, they'll find us. And they'll be like, what are these two people doing? But I tell you what, I'm having tremendous fun with their lives. Right, exactly.
All right, cool, man.
All right, Chief.
Good to see you, dude. Take care. Yeah, and speak soon.
Yeah, happy definitely, birthday, sir. Man. Thank you very much, man. You have a good one.
James Wood said to Peter O'Wella, well, hey, man, you're a pretty weird fella. He said, scream for yourself and say it a bunch. It is a hard way to a naked lunch. I said, a hard way to a naked lunch. James, you got Peter, they are on the same path. Opposite ends of the spectrum, it's enough to make you laugh. But you know what they say when it comes to the crunch? It's a hard way to a naked lunch. A hard way to a naked lunch. Well, man, I want to eat. Well, let's grab a fried dog in the hard way to shame. We are both just a car. Yeah, I guess we should be.
Just been listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include Drunk on VHS, We Came from the Basement, No Budget Nightmares, The After Movie Diner, Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid, and Bloodbaths and Boomsticks. Take one podcast into the shower. Don't be a blithering idiot, Alan. We can give you the multiple podcast cleansing system all in one place that your hair deserves. Our programming is available across all platforms from iTunes to Podomatic, TalkShoe to Stitcher, so you have absolutely no excuse. Listen today and a free naked person of your choice will be shipped from Thailand to your door in a matter of weeks. The Second Unit Podcast Network. Bringing you the action and leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Bloody hell. Who does a girl have to blow around here to get a decent beverage?